This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner, entitled The Healing Process, Spirit, Nature, and Our Bodies. It is in the Collected Works, Volume 319. This is Lecture 11, the last of the set here. It's the part two of a set given in London, titled The Art of Healing from the Perspective of Spiritual Science. This is number two, given in London on August 29th, 1924. Yesterday I described how understanding the supra-sensible human constitution sheds light on states of health and disease. I showed you that the physical, etheric, astral, and I components must be present in very specific proportions in the healthy human being. Although the resulting state of balance is somewhat fluid rather than exact or strict, any substantial deviation from healthy proportions among the four members triggers illness in the human being. I chose two examples to demonstrate this point. Understanding the etheric body on the basis of spiritual scientific research or a spiritual perspective offers insights into cancer, and understanding the nature of the astral body can lead to insights into the complicated syndrome known as Graves' disease. Before we use these examples to illustrate the transition from diagnosis to treatment, I still need to supply some general information on how natural substances take effect when they enter the human organism. Completely understanding the relationship between the natural world and the human organism requires more than simply recognizing the human being as a being of body, soul, and spirit, with a physical body, an etheric body, an astral body, and an I being. As I pointed out yesterday, with regard to silica and carbon dioxide, we must also understand the spiritual factor that forms the basis of all natural substances and processes. This spiritual factor, which can be concretely apprehended by spiritual vision, must be studied in detail. Just as we distinguish between minerals and plants on the physical plane, we must also recognize the spiritual aspect of natural beings in concrete detail. In this context, I want at least to summarize the major categories, although I cannot do more than that. First, let's take a look at minerals in the natural world. Conventional medicine derives a substantial portion of its remedies from the mineral kingdom, and a spiritually based medicine will continue to do so. When we consider the mineral kingdom as a whole, we discover that spirit is bound to minerals in a way that suggests a specific relationship between minerals and the human I, capital. We might think that when we administer mineral substance to a patient, either orally or by injection, the substance itself is the primary agent working on the human body to make it well or sick. In reality, however, the physical mineral substances that chemists and physicists investigate have no effect on the human organism. As purely physical substances, they remain as they are. Spiritual vision reveals that the physical nature of a substance remains almost unchanged when it is removed from the outer world and introduced into the human organism. In contrast, the spiritual aspect of minerals, which is present within their physical aspect, has a very strong effect on the human I being. Because our I contains silica, capital I, contains silica, it masters the spiritual aspect of internalized silica and is profoundly affected by it. This is a very important point. Now, let's move on from the mineral kingdom to the plant kingdom. As I described yesterday, a plant has not only a physical body, but also an etheric body. As a rule, when we administer any plant substance, again either orally or by injection, it works directly on the patient's astral body. This is the general rule, although of course there are exceptions that can be studied individually. As I said, I can give only a general summary here. Similarly, animal substances, any essences, fluids, or other processed substances derived from the animal kingdom, generally affect the human etheric body. This point is especially interesting because the spiritually based medicine I mentioned yesterday has already derived remedies for certain illnesses from the animal kingdom. One example is a pituitary secretion that is used successfully in children with rickets, deformed limbs, or the like. Other animal products also primarily affect the human etheric body, either strengthening or weakening it. It is interesting to note that anything transferred directly from one human being to another has a purely physical effect, and is significant only for the physical organization of the receiver. For example, the effect of receiving a blood transfusion from another person is purely physical. This phenomenon was very easy to study during the transition from human smallpox vaccines to cowpox vaccines. It was possible to trace directly how the effect shifted from the physical body up into the etheric body when animal vaccines began to be used. Thus, when we develop spiritual vision, we can survey how the different kingdoms of the natural world affect the human being. Our eye being draws in the spirit of the mineral kingdom. Our astral body draws in the spirit of the plant kingdom. And our etheric body draws in the spirit of the animal kingdom, while our physical body merely draws in physical aspects from another human being. We can no longer speak of spirit in this last instance. In fact, we can also no longer speak of spirit in the case of the animal substance that affects our etheric body, since this effect is due to the animal's etheric aspect. An understanding of these connections is provided only by a true view of how human beings, whether healthy or ill, are incorporated into the natural world. Such inner vision also allows us to see the ongoing effects of natural substances in the human organism. Now let's ask what we must do in the case of cancer. Yesterday we discussed how the etheric body develops too much strength in a particular organ. The centrifugal forces, the forces that want to move out into the cosmos, become excessively strong. And the astral body and eye being are unable to counteract them sufficiently. At this point, spiritual insight tells us that either we must attempt to strengthen the astral body by turning to the plant kingdom, or we must suppress the effects of the etheric body by turning to the animal kingdom. The initial results of our spiritual research prompted us to attempt to cure cancer by strengthening the astral body. When we look for any remedy that affects the astral body, we must look in the plant kingdom, and in fact our cancer remedy was discovered there. We have been accused of mixing all kinds of amateurish ideas into our efforts, because our first trip toward finding a cure for cancer involved specially processed mistletoe, a parasitic plant that is otherwise used medicinally only in the treatment of epilepsy and similar disorders. Mistletoe, however, is a very special plant. If you look at trees with strange tumor-like outgrowths emerging from their bark, and if you look particularly at a cross-section through these burls, you will realize that something unique is taking place there. In these locations, the normally vertical growth tendency is diverted at a right angle and assumes a horizontal direction, as if a second trunk were beginning to grow outward. In effect, the tree is parasitizing itself. By studying the phenomenon more closely, you find that the physical body of the tree above the burl is always negatively affected. By studying this phenomenon more closely, you find that the physical body of the tree above the burl is always negatively affected. I read that again. Because the physical substance that gets through is not enough to allow the physical body to accommodate the etheric body's forces of growth, the physical body is retarded. The etheric body, whose centrifugal forces normally attempt to fling physical matter out into the cosmos, is left to its own devices in the portion of the tree above the outgrowth. There's a drawing. too little physical substance, or at least substance with too little physical energy, gets through. As a result, the etheric body turns back toward the stronger lower part of the tree. In essence, therefore, the etheric body becomes too strong. Now, imagine instead that a parasitic mistletoe plant establishes itself at the same location. The same phenomenon occurs, but it is caused by a second plant with its own etheric body, rather than by the tree's etheric body. As a result, the mistletoe develops a very specific relationship to the tree. The tree, which is grounded in the soil, assimilates forces from the soil. The mistletoe, which is attached to the tree, assimilates what the tree supplies. That is, it uses the tree as its soil. Mistletoe artificially brings about the same preponderance of the tree's etheric body that occurs naturally in outgrowths. What mistletoe takes from the tree is available only when the tree has a deficiency of physical substance and an excess of the etheric aspect. The etheric excess moves from the tree into the mistletoe. Inner vision reveals that when we process mistletoe in a way that allows this etheric excess to be transferred to a human being via injection, under certain circumstances, mistletoe, as a foreign substance, takes over for the cancer's rampant etheric substance and strengthens the effect of the patient's astral body by suppressing the physical cancer, causing the tumor to disintegrate. When we administer mistletoe substances, we use them as a vehicle for the tree's etheric substance. The actual remedy is etheric tree substance, which strengthens the human astral body. This method requires insight into how a plant's etheric body influences the human astral body. Specifically, how the spiritual aspect of the tree that is pulled out by the parasitic plant affects the astral aspect in the human being. The example of mistletoe supplies concrete confirmation of what I said yesterday, namely that when we use medicinal substances, we are implementing not only what chemistry knows about them, but also the spirit that is present in them. I told you yesterday that in Graves' disease, the astral body stiffens so much that the I being can no longer control it, resulting in the entire syndrome I described. In this case, we need to increase the energy of the I, capital. In this instance, we must look at a substance that plays only a minor role in our ordinary interactions with the natural world. We consume many natural substances, but our food does not contain certain metallic substances, among them copper or copper ores, such as chalcocite or cuprite. The very substances that play no role in our ordinary interactions with the natural world are the ones whose spiritual portions have the greatest effects on the more spiritual aspects of the human being. For example, the copper ore chalcocite, cuprous sulfide, has the strongest possible strengthening effect on the human eye being. When we administer an appropriate preparation of chalcocite to a patient with Graves' disease, we counter the stiffened astral body with an eye that can control it, because the forces contained in chalcocite assist the eye being and restore the necessary balance between it and the astral body. I chose these two examples to demonstrate how any derivative of the natural world can be studied in terms of its effect on the human etheric body, astral body, or eye being. For example, mistletoe or viscum, either the mistletoe that grows on apple trees or the one that grows on pines, affects the etheric body's relationship to the astral body, which deserves special consideration in our search for medicinal means of combating carcinoma. I also explained how chalcocite affects the eye being, and I showed you what needs to be considered in treating Graves' disease. When we learn to perceive abnormal interactions of the physical body, etheric body, astral body, and eye in the diseased human being, and these same interactions as they occur in the natural world. We know, for example, that the eye being is too weak in a patient with Graves' disease, and that chalcocite, a naturally occurring substance, significantly strengthens the eye. Considering such phenomena results in a wonderful insight into the connection between the human being and the natural world, and explains why we ingest many substances in our food while other substances play an insignificant role in healthy human beings. These latter substances, however, begin to play an important part in human beings who are sick, because substances not present in our food have the greatest effect on the spiritual part of the human being. Non-food minerals, plants, and animal products are especially related to the human eye and astral body. With regard to such phenomena, the ability to see into nature's deep secrets and mysteries is especially important, because it alone establishes a direct connection between a sick human being and an effective remedy. If I know that magnets attract iron, I can predict what will happen when I place iron filings close to a magnet. Similarly, I can make a connection between the spiritual aspect of chalcocite and what is wrong with a person with Graves' disease. I imbue medicine with a spiritual perspective. We discover how to make the connections between the healthy or sick human being and external natural substances only by studying the details of the connections among the four members of the human constitution. We must first look at how these connections differ in waking and sleeping, the two alternating states of consciousness that we experience during earthly life. In the waking state, the physical human body is pervaded by the etheric body, and both are filled with the astral body. This whole complex, in turn, is pervaded by the eye being. To put it schematically, and there's a picture, we can imagine the physical and etheric bodies as being filled with the astral body and eye, and extending somewhat beyond the first two members. In contrast, when we confront a sleeping person, what lies there in the bed is the physical body and the etheric body. The human being only comes to the point of developing mineral and plant activity, as plants do, though not, of course, in a vegetable form. The physical and etheric bodies lie there in bed, while the astral body and the eye being are outside the physical and etheric bodies. I can sketch it as follows, and there's another drawing. The astral body and eye surround the etheric and physical bodies like a cloud that grows continually larger and disappears in the distance. It is an oversimplification to say that the astral body and eye being are active within us during the waking state, but absent from the physical and etheric bodies during sleep. This is not the case. We can say only that during the waking state, the eye and astral body work outward in all directions from within the physical and etheric bodies, wherever the dynamics of our organs or organ forces lead them, while during sleep they work from outside. When we sleep, our astral body and eye being surround us. Outside us, they submerge themselves in the spirit of the cosmos and work into the human organism through our eyes, ears, and other surface organs in a way that is somewhat similar to how external events enter our consciousness via sense perceptions and ideas when we are awake. We have described the difference between waking and sleeping by saying that when we are awake, our eye and astral body work outward in all directions from within us, and when we sleep, they work on us from outside, along with all the spiritual forces of the cosmos. We can see that our spiritual forces affect our etheric and physical bodies from both inside and outside. Having clearly understood this phenomenon, we also understand the relationship between the activities of sleeping and waking and the spiritual essences of natural products. For example, the effect of ingested lead, to name just one substance not normally ingested in food, is always to drive out the astral body, just as happens in sleep. Lead puts us to sleep by forcing the astral body and eye being out of the body. Imagine this as vividly as you can. When we ingest lead, we always want to go to sleep, but we cannot really sleep. The eye and astral body are forced out, but lead also hinders them from acting on us from outside. Lead's centrifugal effect moves the astral body and eye out, but it also prevents their centripetal or inward working effects. We fall asleep incompletely because lead blocks effects that should come from outside. Consequently, healthy people who take lead do not fall asleep. Instead, they faint or succumb to dizziness or other conditions that result when the eye and astral body let go of the physical and etheric bodies. Now let's assume, however, that an abnormality appears in a person's constitution. When this person sleeps, the eye being and astral body become too strongly rooted in the world outside the human being. They take up too much of the spirituality of the non-human cosmos, and its effects become too strong. During sleep, the person is too powerfully affected by spiritual influences from outside. The result is sclerosis. This is the true cause of sclerosis. Instead of self-organization from within, the person is exposed to excessively strong effects from outside, especially during sleep. At times, an older human body attempts to resist this process through insomnia, but insomnia cannot persist forever. Consequently, when an older person's astral body and eye leave the physical and etheric bodies during sleep, they receive too many effects from outside and work back on the organism too strongly. In such cases, we find that administering an appropriate lead preparation, instead of causing dizziness or loss of consciousness, simply wards off sclerosing forces. Sclerosing forces, astral and eye forces that approach from outside, are warded off because even though the patient is not really sleeping, the lead drives out his or her astral body and eye being and prevents their excessively strong forces from taking effect from outside. A clear understanding of relationships among the physical body, etheric body, astral body, and I leads to insight into the reasons for the effects of lead and its ability to counteract sclerotic processes. When we clearly understand the human constitution and the spiritual foundations of nature, we can make them interact in ways that have desired effects on health and illness. Of course, we also must be able to combine various effects. I explained how silica relates to the sense organs and the entire periphery of the human body and thus to the eye being. We have just learned that lead also has a certain relationship to the eye. By formulating a remedy that combines silica and lead in the right way, we can strengthen the centrifugal forces of lead or curb the centripetal force of silica to create a remedy with its own inherent vitality. We can predict how this remedy will work in the human organism. A clear understanding of what takes place inside and outside the human being is an essential factor in preparing remedies based on spiritual medicine. The producer must have an overview of the spiritual connections incorporated into the remedies. In addition to the remedies introduced by our materialistic chemistry, which involve mere chemical forces, we can produce remedies that have had cosmic spirituality guided into them in this particular way. The spiritual component will be essential to any remedies that will be produced once the spiritual foundations of medicine have been acknowledged. We will know that it is important for remedies to include not only the aspects chemists understand, but also the spiritual forces of the cosmos. Spirit itself, spirituality itself, will be used directly as a fundamental component of therapy. As you will see, we can go even further in this direction. By clearly understanding the human organism in the way I described yesterday, we will come to a very precise understanding, although I can only suggest it here, of the physical and etheric bodies as the aspect of the human being that is provided by the stream of heredity. This aspect is descended from parents, grandparents, and so on. The I-being and astral body, however, descend from the spiritual world, immerse themselves in the human physical and etheric bodies, and later re-enter the spiritual world through the gate of death. These members are the lasting element that survives the death of the physical body, the immortal aspect that lives and works in each human being. To be strictly scientific, however, we must expand our concept of immortality. The I and the astral body, which constitute the core of an individual human constitution and intervene dynamically in a person's physical and etheric bodies, not only enter the spiritual world through the gate of death, but also exist there before birth or conception. This core of our being comes from the spiritual world and works to build up the physical and etheric bodies. But we must also acknowledge that it exists before birth. The natural sciences are so far removed from the truth in this field that we now speak of immortality only for egotistical religious reasons, because we want to know what happens after death. Because we are already here, we are not interested in what happened before birth or conception. If we want to speak with scientific accuracy, however, we must speak of pre-birth and immortality as the two aspects of eternity. We must also realize that the eternal, essential core of each human being, which submerges itself in the physical and etheric bodies through conception, embryonic development, and birth, and leaves these bodies again at death, must adapt to the physical etheric conformation it enters. In the development of an individual, this process of adapting is not always smooth and easy. It always involves an inner struggle. When a child enters the world, the astral body and I come from the spiritual world, while the physical and etheric bodies come from heredity, from the child's ancestors. A struggle takes place as these two elements attempt to merge. The various types of childhood diseases are outer manifestations of this struggle. We see childhood diseases in the right light only when we view them as the attempt of the eternal core of an individual's being to adapt to what heredity has provided. Especially when the etheric body has difficulty adapting to the astral body and the I-being, we see illnesses developing as a consequence of the etheric body's preponderance over the approaching I and astral body. Rickets is an expression of the etheric body's predominance, its resistance to the invaders, as it were. Tracing the spiritual aspect, in addition to the physical, allows us to discover specific means of negating the power of the etheric body that blocks the astral body. What deprives the etheric body of this power in the normal course of events, as an individual gradually approaches the physical world from the spiritual world during the embryonic period? When we study this period, we discover a specific relationship between forces present in phosphorus, or its compounds, and forces in the uterus that resist embryonic development. If these forces were not present in the uterus, every child would develop rickets. The uterus contains the same type of forces that are present in the outer natural world, in the mineral substance phosphorus and its components. Thus the uterus constantly works like a physician to prevent rickets. Once we have understood these revealed mysteries, we will be able to treat rickets with phosphorus in the outer world after birth to compensate for insufficient phosphorus effects in utero. When we clearly understand the spirit inherent in what is happening in the human being and in our interaction with the natural world, we learn to neutralize existing disease processes precisely by implementing the opposite effects in the right way. This is the basic principle underlying spiritual medicine, as I described yesterday. The book Dr. Wegmann and I have written gives a first formulation of this new science of medicine, which, rather than amateurishly criticizing conventional medical science, is intended to complement it with a similarly exact and scientific study of the spiritual world. anyone who is very familiar with the foundations of modern scientific medicine and explores them just a bit further will feel the need to extend them in the direction of the spirit. In a certain respect, as undesirable and unpleasant as illnesses may be from the perspective of daily life, they provide a great deal of clarity for those seeking the spirit in the human being or spiritual enlightenment with regard to the human being. Illnesses reveal abnormally weakened or strengthened versions of functions that must constantly occur in us so that we can exist as spiritual beings. Simply consider that if we did not have the effects of lead within us, without the actual lead, we would not be thinking beings. Our thought processes would be dulled constantly by latent sclerosis. When we acknowledge this fact, we also realize that the anti-sclerotic lead process I have described here illuminates how thinking develops in human beings. Psychology, the science of the soul, can learn a tremendous amount from diagnostics and therapy. This prospect, however, suggests that when medical science is combined with a spiritual perspective, our worldview will become a somewhat more general one than it is today in all its specialization. Let's look back over the history of human evolution, and especially the intellectual development that has carried human civilization and societies and produced what we call knowledge and science. In times so distant that they are accessible only to the perception available to spiritual researchers, as I described yesterday, the centers of knowledge were not like our schools. In these centers, people learned to understand the natural world and the human being only after their souls had been prepared to see the spiritual aspects of outer objects and events. These centers of knowledge, which we generally call the mysteries, were not simply educational centers, but also encompassed other functions that are separated in today's world. They were centers of religious ritual, centers for the arts, centers for the cultivation of knowledge in all areas of human life. In these ancient mysteries, the teachers began by presenting images, rather than abstract concepts, of what they had to communicate. The inner structure of these images, which were presented in what we would now call a religious ritual, revealed actual circumstances and effects present in the world. Certain offshoots of this practice incorporated beauty into the images, and these branches of the ritual developed into something like art. Science evolved by expressing the content of the images, which were derived from the secrets of the world itself, rather than from any arbitrary fantasy, in the form of ideas. The same content, expressed in a way that elicited piety from human will, was a religious ritual. Expressed in a way that enticed and elevated the human mind with beauty, it was art, and the center for the arts was combined with a religious center. The same content, presented in the form of ideas, was knowledge or science. This content, rather than appealing one-sidedly to human reason, sensory observation, and experimentation, appealed to the whole person of body, soul, and spirit. It delved into the essential nature of objects and events, into the depths where reality was expressed, on the one hand, in a way that stimulated religious piety, and on the other hand, to the context of true ideas. The path that led to the truth, beauty, and morality of human nature was and still is called the path to the initia, to the beginning of all things. The people of antiquity were aware of dwelling in these beginnings and magically incorporating them into their religious rituals, expressions of beauty, and compilations of ideas shaped in accordance with the truth. This approach to the world was called initiation knowledge. Knowledge of the beginnings that allow us to understand all things and tackle them with our will. The people of antiquity were searching for a science of initiation to investigate the world's mysteries and beginnings. A time had to come in the evolution of humanity when this initiation science declined, and human beings used their spiritual energy to become more truly conscious as individuals. People had received the ancient science of initiation instinctively, as if in a dream, and there had been no question of evolving toward freedom. The development of freedom became possible only because human beings were driven away from the origins for a period of time. Instead of pursuing beginnings, we lost the initiation perspective and pursued the ends, and what sensory revelation and experimental research could tell us about them. After experiencing the full and immeasurable breadth of quote-unquote end science or surface science, which can have only a superficial relationship to art and religion, we must now seek initiation with our full consciousness, which has been educated by exact science, and will remain equally exact as we pursue a new science of initiation. This conscious approach to initiation will rebuild the bridge between a worldview, the inner development of ideas that unites human souls with their origins, and its practical applications. In the ancient mysteries, the initiation worldview was united with the art of healing in particular. This view, although it saw healing as an art, also called for recognizing healing as a sacrificial process. Now, this art must once again establish a closer relationship to a more philosophical worldview that appears in order to satisfy the deepest needs of the human soul. The anthroposophical movement, acknowledging what our time demands of us, is seeking this closer relationship. The goal of the anthroposophical movement, which has its center in the Goetheanum, at the Goetheanum in Dornach, Switzerland, is not to spawn arbitrary ideas or to accomplish mystical abstract goals that are foreign to real life. Its intention is to have a hand in all practical human activity. It aspires in full consciousness to the knowledge that was acquired instinctively in ancient primitive times. The connection between the Goetheanum as a center aspiring to a spiritual worldview and Dr. Ita Wegmann's clinic, although merely a beginning, allows us to re-establish the close association of medicine with spiritual perception that was a matter of course in ancient times, when all knowledge was mystery knowledge. In response to the demands of our time, the anthroposophical movement is attempting to make this association a reality. We may hope that this collegial collaboration between a worldview and a clinical practice, our work in the direction of the initia, will engender new life both for initiation knowledge that meets the demands of modern times and for medicine as an initiation science. In these two lectures, I have sketched the first few steps in this collaboration. I know how little can be accomplished by such sketchy indications, and am all the more grateful to Dr. and Mrs. Larkins for making this gathering possible so that I could share these thoughts with you. I would also like to thank you for your attentiveness and assure you that I have not wasted your time, because what I presented to you is truly more than mere theoretical yearnings. Anyone who presents such ideas in public today must be convinced of their truth with every fiber of his or her being. As the end of Lecture 11, the end of the book, The Healing Process, Spirit, Nature, and Our Bodies, by Rudolf Steiner.